Apologies for the poor audio quality in the first 11 minutes of this show. The original hi-fi version was lost, and we had to substitute a lo-fi backup version. Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for January 19, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, looking as we do most weeks at this time at the world of economics and politics. I guess tomorrow will be the first anniversary of the second inauguration of George W. Bush. Celebrate accordingly. I can't think of any way I'd want to celebrate except maybe to look at his low approval ratings. That's one way to celebrate. Got a couple of segments up tonight. First, a replay of an interview or a piece of an interview I did with Dan Lazar back in September when Roberts was nominated to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I was tapped to do the post-Alito hearing roundup last week. Of course, the hearings went on way beyond what one might thought they would have gone on to. But I did want to play comments that Dan Lazar made about the Supreme Court and the fetish we make of it and its role in our constitutional system. It's a point of view that's not often heard, and I think it deserves a wide hearing. So I thought I'd replay it. Since I didn't get to play it last week when there was an immediate news hook, why not play it this week when there's still a news hook? Alito has not yet been confirmed, although it's virtually certain he will be. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded earlier today with the economist Dean Baker on what looks like signs that the housing boom is running out of gas. And Dean Baker is one of the few economists who's been calling this a housing bubble all along, and I think Dean is on the verge of being vindicated. So let's hear. We'll hear in about half an hour what his analysis of what's been going on in the housing market and what is likely to go on in the coming months and years. And before I get to the headlines, I want to say that I am in my own personal news. A big development happened at 7:36 on New Year's morning. My son was born to my wife, Liza Featherstone. I had a son named Ivan Joseph Henwood, born 7:36 New Year's morning, and I could say he's quite splendid in every way, but I am suffering shock. It's quite a life transformation, especially for a guy who turned 53 last month, to have a newborn in a small apartment. But he is beautiful and delightful and splendid, and I'm looking forward to watching him grow. And a couple of songs along those lines later in the show, just excerpts from a couple of pieces of music that were part of the soundtrack I used to welcome Ivan home from the hospital for the first time. Two beautiful songs addressed to children that not a very common genre in the world of popular music, but these are two excellent examples. So we'll hear those later on. Away from the personal news into the sad world of the dismal science. Economics. First of all, it's been a while since I've been here. I had a show on rerun that was preempted, so I think it's been quite a while since I did one of these live, but I think it's been a while since I haven't done a show since the employment report for December was released on January 6th. As usual, the first Friday of every month, the numbers for the previous month's employment performance are released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And the headline payroll gain of 108,000 new jobs in the month of December was a disappointment by any standard, actually not much larger than the survey's margin of error. One bright spot in manufacturing, a sector where gains have been pretty scarce in recent years, that added 18,000. But outside of that, there were a few strong sectors. One exception, and has been consistently for much of the last year or so, was bars and restaurants. They added sorry, I don't have the exact number here, but they are responsible for over 1 in 10, almost 1 in 9 of the new jobs that were produced in the year 2005. This is, as much as I like bars and restaurants, I don't think this is really the sector in which we want to, towards which we want to look for the source of economic dynamism going forward. And the other standout sector, healthcare, which has been for years and years and years adding new jobs, which is certainly good for people who work in that field, though lots of them are really rather low-wage jobs. It's not all brain surgeons, but the increased employment in healthcare is not necessarily good news to the rest of the economy, as the ever-rising healthcare costs are a burden on just about everyone. Employers outside the healthcare field, certainly the cost of health insurance has kept employers from hiring people lately, and also it's been an increasing burden on individuals who are forced to pay more and more out of the pocket to kick in for their insurance coverage or not insured at all. So gains in the healthcare sector, not necessarily such great news for everyone else. We also saw a weak performance, so the average work week down a tenth of an hour, very close to the low of that series, and earnings also very weak, up just a tenth of a percent, and are lagging inflation. So we've seen an erosion in the value of the real wage over the last couple of years, sort of a return of the economic model of the late 70s and the 1980s. The 1980s, of course, we saw what looked like a boom on the surface, but a decline or stagnation in the living standards of average people. We seem to be back in there, although this is not a boom by any measure, even the most conventional measures. Growth rates and such just really not very good at all. We're still about 10 million jobs where we were below where we would be in a normal economic expansion. So it's just the great American jobs machine, as people used to call it, is just not looking so great anymore. Although it was reported this morning that last week's claims for unemployment insurance, the tally of people who lost their jobs and headed over to sign up for benefits, that was down a sharp 36,000 to 271,000, the lowest number since April 2000, which was really as the stock market was topping out, no coincidence there, I hope. That number may have been depressed somewhat by the Martin Luther King holiday. It's very hard to adjust for these numbers week to week, so we shall see if this gets a bounce back next week. But in any case, that's a pretty strong performance, very few other job market indicators looking that strong, so we'll see if this is an anomaly or not. Retail sales for the month of December were kind of weak, below expectations. There was a strong performance for autos, but the non-auto retail sales weak. And it does the American consumer, who has been consuming heroically over the last few years, does show some signs of exhaustion. The weekly ABC News Washington Post consumer confidence numbers, which surveys people's perception of the state of the economy and their own finances, after rising very sharply through October, November, and December, took a steep dive, one of the steepest dives in the history of the index, going from minus 8 to minus 13 last week. I suspect that gas prices may have something to do with that. Gas prices fell as the index was rising, and they've been creeping up in recent weeks. So that has been dominating public perceptions of the state of the health of the economy and people's perceptions of their own finances as well. An interesting factoid I discovered yesterday is that you can explain almost all of the movement in President Bush's approval rating since he took office in January 01 by movements in the price of gasoline. Almost perfect fit. He saw a bounce back in approval ratings the latter months of last year. That I suspect largely the result of the decline in gas prices after their September-October peaks. So we should expect to see that Bush bounce back ending and maybe even going into reverse as the polls come out in the coming weeks. The Mortgage Bankers Association's tally of mortgage applications up in the last week, but mainly because people, a little bounce back in the number of people who are applying for refinancings. And those refinancings in which people have been not only getting lower interest rates, but taking out fresh new cash has been an enormous prop to the economic expansion in the last few years. That had been trending down since its peak in the summer, bouncing up last week, but I don't think this is the reversal of the trend. I think the housing market is showing signs of running out of steam, and we'll hear from Dean Baker on that a little later. This morning I reported that new housing starts fell under the 2 million mark, below economists' expectations, and also the November number was revised downwards. And permits to build new housing, applications for permits to build new housing also off in the month of December. So it looks like the housing market does show some signs of slowing down, if not running out of gas. And finally, the president is running around saying, making some claims. He's given a speech to a small business in Virginia this morning, and he's focusing on small business, citing his administration's policies and major factors for economic growth. He will claim, according to a report that I read in ABC News this morning, that small businesses are the backbone of our economy and the number one job creator in the United States. That's not really true. Small business creates lots of jobs, but also destroys them. On balance, small business is not a particularly large creator of jobs, even though mythology holds that it is. And the president also claims that his tax cuts have been a very important portion of the source of stimulus to economic growth. Well, that hasn't really been so inspiring since economic growth in this cycle has been pretty disappointing, and job growth especially disappointing. So the president doesn't have much to brag about, although he will brag nonetheless, and apparently will do so in the State of the Union address. Let's take a little musical break, and I'll be back to introduce Dan Lazar.
Okay, we're back again. Of course, you're listening to WBAI in New York, and this program is Labrish. My name is Hafez Selassie, and we're speaking with Baba, or maybe Ras Baba.
Can I give a message? Hello?
Go ahead, man.
Yeah, I'd just like to say, let's have some music now, huh?
Okay. Thank you.
You're right.
And then an excerpt from The Clash's Lightning Strikes Not Once But Twice from their album Sandinista. And I'd forgotten that little WBAI ID at the beginning of it. I haven't listened to that album in a few years. I dug it out in search of the song Ivan Meets G.I. Joe, because I was looking for Ivan-related material, being the name of my new son. And so listening to it, I came across that recipe from 25 years ago on these airways, and enough talking, more music is a sentiment I can often agree with, but more talking before the music awaits us here. When John Roberts was nominated to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, I immediately turned to my friend, the journalist Dan Lazar, to offer some critical comments on the Supreme Court. I get so bored with hearing about the court, and I'm so at my wit's end with the way liberals in particular will look to the Supreme Court as some kind of savior, and it's become a real substitute for actual political organizing, agitating, and educating, and so I thought Dan would be the perfect person to rehearse some of these objections for me. And he did. And this is a piece of an interview which I first ran in September of this year. We ranged a little more broadly. We talked about Katrina and the Constitution and many other things. But this is the immediate Supreme Court segment. So this is Dan Lazar, author of the books The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, and a frequent contributor to the books pages of The Nation, Dan Lazar. Well, let's turn a little bit to the Supreme Court. There's acres and acres of coverage of the Supreme Court, the Roberts nomination. Liberals, if we look at the sort of the left side of the political spectrum, liberals are obsessed with the Supreme Court. Is all this obsession justified?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, the Supreme Court is, you know, has emerged from the least important of the three branches to the most important of the three branches. I mean, all the other branches, especially Congress, have been happy to shunt off responsibility under the backs of the courts. This has been a process that's been going on for 50 years now.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, starting in the 1940s, I mean, Congress was happy to duck the important issues, such as race, for example, and leave it to the Supreme Court to decide. And both liberals and conservatives collaborated in this ducking of responsibility. And and of course, when the Supreme Court did decide, and you know, in Brown v. Board of Ed in 1954, liberals were ecstatic and were convinced that their strategy had paid off, because they'd created this kind of new liberal court, or this new liberal court had been created since 1937, and it was a powerful new instrument for social reform. So they were happy to have, you know, Congress marginalized, and this the Supreme Court then take the lead.
Well, let's go back into the 30s, though, when Roosevelt was unhappy with the court. He tried to pack it with a whole bunch of new members who would be friendly to him. So what happened to the liberals who then made friends with the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, Roosevelt lost the battle and won the war. The court packing proposal was beaten back, but the in what I think was Abe Fortas labeled the I forgot. I'm sorry. Anyways, the court did an about face and suddenly approved all the New Deal legislative proposals that they had previously overturned.
And well, it's an old cliche. The Supreme Court reads the election returns.
Right.
Who said that? Where did that come from?
That I think was a famous columnist in the early part of the 20th century. But the idea is, yes, the court is supposedly above politics, but nothing is really ever above politics. So the court is certainly aware of what's happening outside its chambers. But the 1937 started the court on a great trek to the liberal side of the spectrum. But that has essentially stopped since the 1970s. Roe v. Wade in 73 probably marked the high watermark. And the conservatives have mounted a great counteroffensive, and have succeeded in pushing the court farther and farther to the right, and transforming it, returning it to its traditional role as a guardian of conservative constitutional virtues in this country. And certainly, the Roberts nomination is part of that trend. Bush wants to, you know, even if Bush is ridden out of town on a rail, he wants to leave, you know, govern from the grave by leaving his imprint on the court.
Or government from his ranch in
right.
his retirement. Well, let's go back into history. How did the court emerge coming out of the Constitution in its early years? How did the Supreme Court emerge into this extraordinarily powerful role as an arbiter of whether laws were proper or not?
Well, you have a document, you have a Constitution, which is almost impossible to change. So consequently, everything and interpretation becomes all important, and the court, even no matter how reluctant it's been at various points, has been essentially forced to serve as interpreter in chief, and this is a very powerful position, and we see at key points the court has stepped in and interpreted the Constitution in various ways, and which has just really altered the course of American political development. You know, there's some of the rulings on states' rights, on contract law in the early 19th century, certainly on slavery in the 1850s, which led directly to the Civil War. And then, you know, of course, in the post-Civil War period, a series of rulings that were increasingly favorable to large corporations, which facilitated the explosive growth of American corporate capitalism.
And, of course, there's always this ridiculous fetish of trying to figure out what the framers meant. But what was the intention of the Supreme Court? Was it intended as some kind of check on democracy or what?
It was originally considered to be the least important of the three. It was going to be sort of the umpire, and everyone assumed that Congress would be the most important of the three. Congress would sort of serve as a quasi-parliamentary body. And Congress would set policy, which the president would then carry out, and the Supreme Court would occasionally step in to adjudicate disputes. But obviously the courts, as Congress has withered and as politics have withered, the court has played an increasingly, you know, dominant role until now. It has now gone from the least important, the least among equals, to the greatest among equals.
And what do you make of Roberts himself?
Oh, Roberts is, I mean, he's clearly bad. I mean, he seems to be bad, but of course this whole process is so enigmatic that you never really can be quite sure. Everyone has the David Souter example in mind, where Souter seemed to be a conservative Republican, and now has blossomed into what seems to be a somewhat liberal member of the Supreme Court. So
it's very weird. You appoint these guys, you don't really understand exactly what they're all about, and then they're around for 30 years.
Well, it's an example of how the system really, really dissolves accountability. There really is no accountability, and there really is no responsibility. People, you know, senators will go and vote for this guy, and they'll have the perfect excuse. They really have no idea who they're voting for.
There's this presumption the president deserves the person that he nominates.
There's a presumption that
unless president's you're favorite. Like, you know, got some raving scandal in a skeleton in his closet. But.
Right, which is why they always play the game of trying to find the scandal. But yeah, the presumption is
but
always.
We're pretending it's not a political appointment. So.
Right, supposedly the law is above politics. And to a strange way, it is above politics in this country, which is why we've seen the incredible expansion of the legal realm and the shrinkage of the political realm, and shrinkage both, you know, quantitatively and qualitatively, where, you know, where political intelligence is just plummeting. You have this amazingly nihilistic ruling class and a population at large, which a large portion of which is simply just turned off and hopelessly inert.
But the Supreme Court is still one of the most respected institutions of our society.
Yeah.
Which says something about our society, I guess. But well, one of my beefs with the court is that, or there's this whole litigious or legalistic approach that a lot of liberals pursue these days, which is that, you know, it's all about filing lawsuits. There's no organization. There's no ideological agitation. You look at the pro-choice movement. It really has done almost no kind of political organizing. We depend on the court to protect our civil liberties. You know?
That's quite true. I mean, liberals were in a very bad spot in the 40s and 50s. The Congress was dominated by these hidebound reactionaries and Southern Dixiecrats. You know, really controlled all the major committees. And so that avenue seemed to be totally blocked as an avenue for reform. So the liberals, you know, turned to the courts. But clearly, in hindsight, over the long haul, they ended up making a pact with the devil, because as they turned to the courts, they became increasingly litigious, cut off from any democratic base, and politics came to be articulated in this highly arcane academic discourse of constitutional law. And meanwhile, the average person was sort of left off, you know, was marginalized and was, you know, was often very resentful over his or her marginalization. So consequently, a mass, you know, kind of a basis was created for a kind of a mass resistance, the famous silent majority of the Nixon years.
But then, you know, this kind of takes us back to where we started, which is this immense detachment of the American public from politics is no accident, as the vulgar Marxists used to say. It's a whole process of structural decisions that have brought it about.
Well, I think the first of the theory behind the Constitution itself is a theory of the people are a mob, therefore the people must be controlled by a body of unalterable law. Number one, but number two is as the system has become increasingly sclerotic over the years, that process has gone farther and farther. So the people are more and more marginalized. They are profoundly undemocratic features of the U.S. Constitution, which the people are simply powerless to change due to an abstract body of law which says that people can't affect it. The Second Amendment, the question of equal state representation in the Senate, which is just...
The Senate literally cannot be abolished under American constitutional right now.
It can't be reformed. It can't be... The principle of equal state representation is literally unchangeable. It would require the unanimous approval of all 50 states to change.
Which would never happen.
Which would never happen. So therefore, consequently, you have a lily-white Wyoming has the same number of senators, the same number of votes as a California, which is what the first minority-majority state, where whites are actually a minority. This exists nowhere else in the world. There's nowhere, I mean, no other legislative body is this inequitable, this undemocratic. And
but that was the design of the Senate, wasn't it?
It was, but the inequities were much less in the 1790s than they are today.
But wasn't it what's that phrase of Jefferson's? It was a saucer meant to cool the hot tea? Or?
That was actually Washington's phrase. That was the idea. The idea is that the people are a mob. They're passionate. They're unthinking. So therefore, we must surround them with all kinds of legal hedges to rein them in. This is a very undemocratic concept. But the idea is, you know, so we have the Senate. We have this profoundly undemocratic, profoundly racist millionaires club we call the U.S. Senate, which the people, no, made in the people's name, but which the people are unable to reform. They're prevented by law from reforming. Second Amendment is the same thing. The Electoral College is the same thing. It's all this increasingly sclerotic, paralyzing structure.
But of course, we take the Constitution as a sacred document.
Yeah, whatever happens, and I assume that Roberts will be confirmed. But even if he was stopped, I mean, this process of decay is going to accelerate. That is I'm absolutely sure of that. We'll see one too many New Orleanses.
And that, the voice of Dan Lazar, who is a journalist, author of several books. Most relevant to what he was talking about was The Velvet Coup, his piece on his book, a short book from Verso on the 2000 decision that gave George Bush the presidency. Before that, the Frozen Republic, which came out around 1996, his critique of the American constitutional system, unusual point of view that deserves wider attention. So I thought I would rerun that bit of the interview that was first broadcast in September after the Roberts nomination in honor of the Alito nomination. Let's take a little break for a station ID, and then I'll be back to play some music and talk about Dean Baker.
This is WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Reverend Jesse Jackson. Please call and support WBAI, Non-Commercial Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
And this show is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we are WBAI at 99.5 FM on the radio dial, and also at WBAI.org on the web. And many good things on the website. You should always check it out. And you could always pledge to WBAI, even though we're not in fundraising mode at the moment. We'll always take your pledge on the website, and you can check out the merchandise there. And you can also listen to archives for the last several weeks of what's been broadcast. If you've missed or want to rehear, you can find it all there, WBAI.org. Let's take a little musical break. This is one of the two songs addressed to by fathers to their children. This is the song Wear Clean Draws from The Coup, Boots Riley and The Coup. This is addressed to a girl, but it's very, very touching. Gets me all choked up when I listen to it. I think a lesson also for a boy to listen to as well. A little bit of popular feminism. Boots Riley and The Coup, well, a minute and a half from Wear Clean Draws.
Courage, express with care. Go on, draw them superheroes with the curly hair. You my daughter, my love, more than kin to me. This for you and the woman that you finna be. Tell that boy he's wrong, girls are strong. Next time at show and tell, play a Mars song. Tell your teacher, I said princesses are evil. How they got all their money was to heal people. If somebody hit you, hit them back. Then negotiate a peace contract. Life is a challenge and you gotta team up. If you play house, pretend that the man clean up. You too busy with the other things you gotta do. When you start something, now remember, follow through. Later on, you gon' blossom like a lotus. You'll get in the boys and the boys gon' notice. It don't matter who you do it with. Just remember when I tell you, baby, you the sh**. Handshakes are promises, lies can spoil it. Words should be binding sealed. Wash your hands after using the toilet. Brush after every meal. And also,
let me go.
And that minute and a half from the song Where Clean Draws from The Coup and Boots Riley. And one of two songs playing in this half hour that fathers are addressing to their children and gets me all choked up. It did before, but now that I have one of my own, it's getting me even more choked up. But no time for being choked up. The show must go on, of course. It was reported this morning that housing starts in the United States, beginning of construction on new houses, that is, came in under 2 million at an annualized rate, which was considerably below what most economists were projecting. And yet another sign that the torrid housing market in the United States, almost unprecedented, I think truly unprecedented. We don't have any statistics for the 1920s. There may have been something like that then, but certainly nothing like this since the end of World War II when the good numbers began. Just mad appreciation, especially in the hot markets around the country. What does it mean? Where did it come from? Where is it going? And what happens if it starts falling apart? The economist who's been at the forefront of studying this has been Dean Baker, who is the co-director for the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. You can read his stuff on housing at cepr.net on the web, cepr.net on the web. But this interview recorded earlier today, Dean Baker.
This morning we heard that housing starts are off. Is the housing bubble finally losing some air?
Well, I think it's definitely losing air. I mean, there's a lot of signs all pointing in the same direction. I mean, you can't make too much of one month's data. But it does look like housing starts are off their peak. They were, for the year, they were almost 2.1 million, which is the second highest on record. So it's a really extraordinary number. But in the last few months, they have been down. If you look at other measures, the inventories of unsold homes is up. If you look at existing home sales, those seem to be falling. And there's also a lot of anecdotal evidence that places are sitting longer. And in some places, you're seeing price declines. You're seeing people advertising price reductions, something that didn't happen in markets like D.C., New York, Boston. That didn't happen at all, you know, a year ago, but that is showing up in these places. So there's definitely air coming out. It doesn't mean a collapse yet, but I think we're past the peak.
Of course, you've been one of the few economists who've been keeping very close watch on this. The official line all along has been reassurance. So why don't you make your case for the fact that there has been a housing bubble over the last several years?
Yeah, well, if you go back over the post-war period, the period where we have good data, house prices had pretty much followed the same tracked overall inflation. So from 1952-53, the first year which we have good data, until about 1996, overall house prices on average had moved at almost exactly the same rate that inflation did over that period. Suddenly in 1996-97, house prices start to increase more rapidly, interestingly coinciding with the stock bubble, similar sort of story to what you had in Japan in the 80s when you had a real estate bubble and stock bubble side by side. But in any case, since that period, house prices have risen by almost 50% on average, adjusted for inflation. So the nominal growth has been considerably more rapid, but adjusting for inflation, from 96 to the present, house prices nationwide are up on the order of 50%. Now, huge regional variation, so in much of the area, much of the country, there's nothing particularly unusual. So through the Midwest, the South, for the most part, there's been nothing unusual in terms of house prices in those areas. But in areas like the East Coast, going north of D.C., that includes New York, Boston, other East Coast cities, the West Coast, most of California, certainly Seattle and Portland, you've had house prices rising in some cases 70-80% after adjusting for inflation. So this is unprecedented run-up in home prices, and you're very hard-pressed to find anything in the fundamentals. There wasn't, you know, population growth is slowing, income growth hasn't been particularly rapid during this period. It was pretty good in the late 90s, not unprecedented, but pretty good. It's actually been very slow the last 4 or 5 years, so you can't tell, you know, any sort of easy demand side story. In terms of supply side, as I just said, we're building houses at a very rapid rate, so you know, it's very hard to say that there's been some restriction on supply that would explain that sort of run up. And most importantly, what I look to is that there's been nothing like this in rents. So if there are really some fundamentals in the housing market that, or real estate market, I should say, that was creating upward pressure on housing price in general, we'd expect to see a comparable story in the rental market and the ownership market, and really not seeing it at all on the rental side. So, you know, when you go, here's this huge run-up in house prices, it's never happened before, no precedent, we can't find any sort of fundamental reason, and it's not showing up in rents, you go, well, is this, you know, is this fundamentals or is it a bubble? I think it's a pretty strong case, it's a bubble.
Some analysts will argue that the run-up in house prices is justified by the fact that we've had generational lows in interest rates. What do you say to that?
Well, I think there is something to the interest rate story, but that's a bubble story because, you know, we've had extraordinarily low interest rates, particularly long-term rates. We've had the lowest mortgage rates since the mid-50s. You know, at the bottom of this, if you go back to June of 2003, the 30-year mortgage rate was down around 5.25, 5.3. We hadn't seen that since, you know, about 54, 55. So that certainly has played a role in this, but this is a story to say that house prices could fluctuate that much in response to interest rates, which I should point out they had not in the past, but let's for the moment say that now they do because of changes in the market. Well, the implication is that when interest rates go back up, which just about everyone expects that they will and is projecting that, then house prices will plummet. So if you want to say that, well, because the 30-year rate has fallen to, you know, at 1.525, you know, you get house prices where they are, well, then the implication is, well, when the 30-year rate goes back to, you know, 7.2, 7.3, 7.5, which, you know, is pretty much what most people expect it to be at in a year or 2 years, then house prices will go back to where they were, you know, which that's a story that says we have a bubble. You know, it's a little different in the sense that you're tying it very directly to the interest rate. I think the interest rate is very important, but I don't think that's the whole story. But nonetheless, the implication is the same, that when that in some point in the not-very-distant future, we're going to see a very big fall in house prices.
It looks sometimes to me as if the housing bubble like just took up the baton from the stock market bubble. The stock market bubble fell apart in mid-2000, and that's when the housing market really, really accelerated. Do you see any relation between the two?
Yeah, I think there is a very strong relationship. I mean, it's, you know, this is kind of speculative, but, you know, sort of the basic story seems to fit that what happened was they started at more or less, I shouldn't say started at the same time, the stock bubble started first, but what happened was the stock bubble fed into the housing bubble in the mid-90s because, you know, people make a lot of money in the stock market. They look to get a bigger, better home, and at least in the short term, available housing is more or less in fixed supply. So you get an increase in demand, more or less fixed supply. So in the areas where people have made a lot of money in the market, and there have been some studies on this place like Silicon Valley, that pushes upward, puts upward pressure on house prices. Then people begin to expect house prices to continue to rise. So you get laid into this, the crash of the stock market, and suddenly people don't think the stock market's a safe place to put their money. They look to the housing market and say, that's a safe place. So you have a lot of people sort of directly going from the stock market to the housing market. But then on top of that, the response of the Federal Reserve Board to the stock market crash was to lower interest rates and to push the short-term interest rate down to the lowest we've seen since the 50s, which in turn helped the long-term rate fall. So you get a sequence of events, you know, tied to the stock bubble and its collapse that can explain the run-up in the housing market. So it's not a simple story. Every time we get a run-up in stock prices, we'll get a housing bubble. But I think it's easy to tell the story. And again, it's a little harder to prove each step along the way. But, you know, I think basically the facts fit that story.
There's some amazing stuff that came out from the National Association of Realtors early this week. But 43% of new first-time home buyers had no down payment at all. And the average down payment for all first-time buyers was 2%. How do those numbers strike you?
Yeah, well, those are really incredible numbers, because, you know, you'd expect that most lenders would want people to put something down, because those are obviously not very well secured loans. So the two sides of the story, from the standpoint of, you know, the person buying it, for the most part, the reason people are putting themselves in this situation is because they're stretched. I'm sure most people would rather be able to put 5 or 10 or 20% down, which is historic amounts that people used to put down when they bought a home. But they're feeling very stretched. They look at the prices today, and, you know, they have to stretch, you know, as far as they can just to make their payments. So they don't have, you know, the $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 that they might need to put down a normal down payment on the house. So people are really skimping. You have a lot of people getting interest-only loans, so they don't have to pay off any principal. Again, that's probably something most people would not, you know, they'd rather be acquiring equity in their house, but they have enough trouble making ends meet, so they're just they're happy to get an interest-only loan. So long and short of it is, you create a situation in which the lenders, the buyers are very vulnerable to anything bad happening. If, you know, if you have a couple, two in a couple, one of them loses their job, they can't make their payments, they have no equity to draw on, someone gets sick, you know, again, same sort of story. When you have a variable rate mortgage, if that interest rate goes up, which just about everyone expects them to do, people are going to be very stretched to meet those payments. So you're in a situation where a lot of people are going to find that they can't hang on to their home. So from the buyer's side, that's got to be really bad news. But you would think also from the lender's side, you know, obviously they're lending money with the idea of making a profit. And, you know, you have this problem here that the people who are most often marketing the loans are mortgage agents who are independent of the banks that might actually hold them, or whoever's holding them, the investors that end up holding the loans. But they're making money by selling the loan, but whoever ends up holding it, a lot of those are clearly going to go bad. And if someone's unable to make their monthly mortgage payments, and the home is only worth, you know, 90, maybe even 80% of the market of the value of the loan, which will be the case in many cases, you know, people are going to take really big losses on them. So it's really bad news for someone who's the buyer and might find themselves in a situation where they're forced to give up their home in a couple of years. But it's also not a particularly good deal for the investor who's holding that mortgage.
I'm speaking with Dean Baker, who is co-director of the Center of Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. What about all the – it's not just the houses themselves have been the focus of feverish activity, but people have been borrowing money very aggressively against the appreciated value of their housing. What do you – what's your estimate of the size of this mortgage equity withdrawal, and how important has it been to economic growth in recent years?
Well, it's on the order of $400 billion a year. I mean, you get that by looking at the growth mortgage debt minus the amount that you could sort of credibly assume went to buying homes. And so it's very substantial, and it shows up clearly in the data in the sense that if we look at the national savings rate, the household savings rate, it's below zero for the first time since the Depression. So we have a negative savings rate in the third and fourth quarter. In fact, we're virtually certain to have a negative savings rate for the calendar year 2005. And ordinarily what you would expect is a savings rate around 8 to 10%. And it's really striking given the country's demographics, because we have the whole baby boom cohort still pretty much in their prime earning years. The very oldest are hitting 60, so they're, you know, a lot of those people are now retired. But still, the vast majority of the baby boom cohort is still working, and that should give us a situation where you have a higher than normal savings rate. Instead, you know, we're looking at a savings rate that's negative. And that's very troublesome for two reasons. One is you have a lot of people that are approaching retirement, and, you know, they aren't going to have much by way of assets, their Social Security, thankfully, but they won't have much by way of assets other than their home. And if their home ends up being worth a lot less than, you know, what it is today, they're not going to have a very good retirement. So, you know, for an awful lot of baby boomers, the years they should be saving a lot, they're not, because they think that, you know, their home's just going through the roof, and, you know, they're expecting to continue to, and they're in for a rude surprise. But the other part of the story is simply from the standpoint of the economy as a whole, that's been fueling the economy ever since the stock crash, really. That on the one hand, we've had, you know, a construction boom, but also we've had a consumption boom, and that's, you know, helped sustain growth, create jobs. But that will go into reverse, and when that does, you're probably talking about a very severe recession. So it's not going to be a pretty picture.
Oh, we've only got about less than 2 weeks, I guess, to kick around Alan Greenspan, so let's do a little bit of that. All along, Greenspan has been, or at least until very recently, Greenspan has been rather a calming force towards those who have been worried about a housing bubble. He's said
it's really nothing to worry about. The creative minds in the financial sector have been creating all these wonderful new mortgage products to make housing more affordable to everybody. He has been just thoroughly sanguine in the face of what looks to you and me like a speculative mania. What do you make of Greenspan's role in this?
Well, it's been very interesting. I mean, it's important to think back to what he did during the stock bubble. He said in retrospect that he recognized the bubble and he thought it best not to do anything about it. In fact, we have the transcripts, so we know that was true. He did see the bubble there, but he thought that we have the transcripts of the Federal Reserve Board meeting, that's what I'm referring to. So we know that, you know, that did reflect his views at the time, 98, 99, 2000. He recognized there was a bubble, but he said he thought it was the Fed's best for the Fed not to take action. You know, I think we could infer from that even if he saw a housing bubble, he wouldn't say anything and he wouldn't take action, because, you know, that was quite explicitly what he said with the stock bubbles. Unless he's changed his views about financial asset bubbles in the last few years, we should assume he'd act the same way. Now, I would actually go a step further and say that he consciously promoted the housing bubble by making these comments at various points denying there was any problem in the housing market. So I think my guess is that he quite deliberately promoted the bubble with the idea that we have this bad recession, which we did in 2001 with the stock crash, coming off the stock crash, that was not easy to recover from. The prior recessions in the post-war period were all the result of the Fed raising interest rates too much, bringing about a collapse of the housing and the auto market, which has the benefit of, it's easy to correct. You just lower interest rates, and all the people that weren't buying homes and cars suddenly go out and buy homes and cars as it becomes affordable. So it gives a really big boost to the economy. With the stock crash, the big factor was the fall off in investment, and there's not an easy way to get investment recharged, certainly not simply by lowering interest rates. My guess is that he saw the housing market as the only thing going. He obviously recognized that you had substantial run-up in house prices. He saw that, you know, the building boom was beginning, or more than beginning, well underway. And he decided that this was the best way to fuel the economy going forward, with the hope that you'd keep the housing market going strong until investment kicked in or something else kicked in to maintain the economy. And as it's turned out, nothing else really has kicked in any very big way. So, you know, 3 years later, 4 years later, we're still very much dependent on the strength of the housing sector, and the bubble's probably gotten much, much higher than he anticipated it would get. But, you know, I think he made a bad call in not doing anything about the stock bubble, and I think, you know, in retrospect, history will judge this to be an even worse call to have not done anything and, in fact, promote the housing bubble.
And as you pointed out, the savings rate towards the end of last year went negative, but it had been very close to zero in the years before that.
Yeah.
So all this housing expansion has been funded primarily by money coming in from abroad. How seriously do you take the international dimensions of this?
Well, that's the other very big part of the story, that, you know, right now we have this huge trade deficit, and it's being financed by foreign inflows of capital. And importantly, a lot of those foreign inflows are coming from foreign central banks, which means it's not that we have all these investors out there around the world who just decide the U.S. is a great place to make lots of money. We have foreign central banks who are quite deliberately putting money in the U.S. economy to, one, keep the dollar high, and two, I think they've made a decision they want to keep our housing bubble going. So you have foreign central banks, most importantly China and Japan, but others doing this as well, that they're not just buying up dollars, they're buying up 10-year treasury notes, they're buying up long-term bonds, and they have to know that this is a way to keep our long-term interest rates low. So you have sort of an interesting situation here, that you have Alan Greenspan, who's been gradually raising short-term interest rates, which is the Fed's preferred instrument. They work on the overnight money rate, with the expectation that that would also, in time, lead to higher long-term interest rates. And what actually has happened, because the Japanese and Chinese central banks, as well as the other central banks, have intervened directly in the long-term market, they've completely offset Greenspan's actions in that respect. So long-term interest rates are only a little higher today than when Greenspan first began to raise interest rates back in June of 2004. So what you see here is that, for the moment at least, the inflow of foreign capital, particularly the capital from the central banks, has sustained the U.S. housing market. But somewhere down the road, presumably, they're going to decide that they have better things to do with their money than, you know, lend it at very low interest rates to people in the United States so that they can buy bigger homes or more expensive homes. And there will be a big price to pay. And, in fact, for all the people who like to run around worried about the budget deficit, it's worth noting our trade deficit is about twice the size of the budget deficit. So, you know, it basically affects the economy in the same way, and there's some differences. But the basic story story is the same. So anyone who wants to be concerned about the budget deficit should be at least twice as concerned about the trade deficit.
And I suppose a lot of people might be listening, and they're saying, oh, okay, but so what? And Greenspan himself said there's never been a really sustained decline in the housing market since the end of World War II, which is not exactly true, but there's certainly not been a rout as there has been in the stock market. Houses are not like stocks. People don't trade them as rapidly, and they need them to live in, so they're not going to dump them the way they dumped Pets.com. So what do you see as the ultimate resolution here?
Well, it's classic bad logic when he says, you know, there hasn't been a nationwide fall in the housing market because there hasn't been a nationwide run-up like this. But it's, you know, a little off the wall to say that, well, because it was true in the past, it's sort of like saying I've never fallen off a 20-story building, therefore I can't. It's a very bizarre claim. But secondly, the claim that people could live in their houses, therefore, you know, the prices won't fall. Well, we've been selling homes. The amount of house sales, existing home sales, has been around 7 million a year the last couple of years. And that could fall. There's a lot of people who have a choice whether to sell their home or not, but there's a lot of people who don't have a choice. They move across country. They someone loses a job. A family breaks up. So, you know, even if that number fell in half, that means you still have to have 3.5 million people who are prepared to buy a home. And if people look at the current prices and they're convinced they're going to fall, then they won't buy them at those prices. I should also point out that Alan Greenspan is being very inconsistent here because I know he's argued in other contexts, specifically the context of taxing financial transactions like currency trades or stock trades, that when you have a thinner market, you have less people trading, that makes it more volatile. So here he's turning around and saying, well, because the housing market's this very thin market, there aren't that many people out there who might potentially buy my house, that somehow makes house prices more stable. Whether or not that's true, that goes directly against what Alan Greenspan has said in other contexts. So I'll let him choose which one he wants, but he can't get both.
So say the housing market rolls over and then starts, or housing prices and volume of sales starts falling. What do you see as the outcome of that? Will there be an economic side effect?
Oh, absolutely. What you're going to see is that you'll have almost certainly a recession, probably a very severe recession. Housing construction itself accounts for about 6% of GDP. If we eliminated the housing wealth-driven consumption, that's on the order of about 4% of GDP. If you get this fall off over the span of a year or 2 years, that's a very, very big hit to the economy, and it's not as though there's something that can easily jump in and fill that gap. We're talking about a recession, as I say, one that might be very, very hard to get out of. The stock crash, the recession following stock crash is very hard to get out of, and Greenspan conveniently seized on the housing bubble. But it's not clear, you know, what, you know, there's not likely to be another bubble that you could promote to get us to recover from a downturn in the housing market.
And finally, Greenspan is leaving office in about 10 days to be succeeded by Ben Bernanke. What's the policy challenging that faces Bernanke? Everybody assumes he's just going to go on autopilot.
Well, I think he's going to have some very tough choices to make in the not-distant future. I mean, on the one hand, I think inflation is somewhat higher than most people have recognized. I think the core inflation rate, actually in the most recent numbers, the core inflation rate over the last quarter was about 2.8%, which is not something that troubles me, but that is something that is likely to trouble financial markets if that stays there or goes a little higher, which I think it very well might. So he's going to be in a tough decision whether he decides to keep raising rates or not. And then also, my guess is that in his watch, this could be very soon, could be a couple years down the road, we will see this reversal where the foreign central banks stop supporting the dollar, stop keeping U.S. interest rates down, long-term interest rates, and he will probably have to deal with the fallout from that. He'll have to deal with the crash, in other words.
And at the voice of Dean Baker, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C., and an economist who has studied the housing bubble like none other, and now I think reality is catching up with him. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening, and I want to go out with yet another one of these songs directed towards a child. This one, David Bowie wrote just after his son Zoe was born, probably about 30 years ago. This is called Kooks, and this one is going out to my newborn son, Ivan, who probably can't understand it yet, but maybe someday he will. Till next week, bye.
Will you stay in our love story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing. Will you stay in a lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing. Bought a lot of things to keep you warm and dry, and a funny old crib on which the paint won't dry. I bought you a pair of shoes, a trumpet you can blow, and a book of rules of what to say to people when they pick on you. 'Cause if you stay with us, you're gonna be pretty cookie too. Will you stay in our lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe.